I now welcome Reverend David McGinley to come and speak. And I'm incredibly impressed by the fact that in addition to working full-time as a staff chaplain at the QE2, Reverend McGinley has also managed to find time and energy to write a book entitled Beyond Surviving, Cancer, and Your Spiritual Journey. And I understand this was due to many, many mornings getting up at 4 a.m. and working away on it, a kind of discipline that I have tremendous respect and awe for. Reverend McGinley begins with a reading from that book. So welcome.
Good morning, everyone. Pleasure to be back. It's been about a year or more since I've been here, and it's a privilege. Before I read this section, I just want to point out that looking back at getting up at 4 in the morning every morning for 2 years feels like a hallucination. It feels like it was somebody else. And yet I was compelled and seemed to wake automatically about that time. Despite that effort, my wife says I was still glued to the computer screen for 2 years in writing this book. And I thought that would be the hard part, but after it's written, you have to get it published, and my goodness, that is excruciating. Torturous, and I'm still trying to get it published, but moving steadily along towards that. In our songs, in our meditations, in our awareness, we have been gathered this morning working with only one thing, our consciousness. Trying to modulate, amplify, resonate with love, with something congruent and higher that will manifest beyond our lives and ripple out to affect in some mysterious way the chaos of this world, to help tune people's souls to love. I'm going to read you a story about love. And while many of the stories in my book are quite sad, the book is about hope, and I think is quite positive. The Hail Mary pass. That's what an unrelated bone marrow transplant is, and Brenda was going for the longest Hail Mary we'd ever seen. Her leukemia had been very aggressive, resistant to chemotherapy, spreading quickly. She had no time to harvest healthy stem cells, no siblings from which to draw that biological miracle that would reprogram her entire immune system. The only option was a matched unrelated donor transplant. And there was no time to find a match that was good. The closest we could locate was far below optimal, 6 out of 10 of the variables that we're trying to match. But you really begin to consider the Hail Mary pass when you are Mary. It looks better than certain death, at least it does in the beginning. Or, I'm sorry, when you're Brenda. For Brenda was a young one in her 30s with 2 daughters and all of life ahead. My first visit with her was remarkable. Enabled by the grace of the encounter and the gift of her amazing spirit, our conversation quickly went to the worst-case scenario. I don't think I'm going to die, even though the odds are against me. Something in the tone and quality of her presence made that statement resonate with a conviction, but also a bit of hesitation. You say that in an interesting way, I replied. Well, I'll tell you, I haven't mentioned this to anyone, not even to my husband, but I had an experience. It was just the other night. I've been thinking about it ever since. My ears begin to tingle when I hear things like that. I was lying here, and the room was suddenly filled with this presence. Amazing peace, amazing deep love. This light, the air was changed with this light, and I don't know how to explain it other than it must have been the presence of God. It was beautiful. I felt so safe and so clear about what lies ahead. I paused. What lies ahead? Yeah, she said, this is going to work out just fine. I don't need to be afraid. I'm not alone. Even if my body suffers, I'm going to come through this. And then she said, even if I die, I'm going to come through this. Have you ever felt this before? I asked. Now she paused, Slowly a look of recognition came to her, and her eyes welled up. Yes. Yes, when my first daughter was born, it was a difficult delivery, touch and go. But I felt that same peace come over me, and I knew I would survive. It was that same presence. So, I said, it was for love that you were to remain, for the love of your child and for the one to come after. Your growth here in love was not complete. She was weeping now. But does that mean if I die, then it's because my growth in love is finished? I wonder if it's ever complete, I said. I wonder if it continues. I hope so. Me too, she said. My last visit with Brenda was equally humbling and inspiring. Her skin was now amber, indicating her kidneys and liver were on the verge of collapse. Jaundice first appears in the eyes, the whites turn yellow, and then skin follows along with lethargy and confusion. Carbon dioxide builds in the blood. It was to the point that even her tears were yellow, staining the pillow. Her skin was peeling and weeping from her body. Her corneas had disintegrated. Large sections of her body were wrapped in gauze to absorb fluid from burst capillaries. Sores filled her mouth and extended down her throat through her entire digestive tract, and her bowels were constantly flowing. The sight of this for nurses is very difficult. It can leave one feeling helpless, and the excellent care and compassion are not enough to assuage the heart, which must break. It's all the worse for loved ones. Yet through them, we witness such presence, such beauty as they remain with the suffering. Their love becomes stronger than their fear or their helplessness. Or perhaps it's all that remains when false hope drops away. I called upon that love from God as I sat at her side. What can one say? The truth. And so it is happening. I said to her. Yes, she whispered. It is critical to assess physical distress first before spiritual. One cannot care for the soul until you care for the body. How is your pain? I asked her. 1 out of 10. 15, she said. I glanced at the bags hanging from the IV pole. There was Dilaudid, a strong narcotic, but at what dose? Is the pain everywhere? I asked. She nodded. Are you afraid? No, not of dying. I'm looking forward to that. It will be a release. I know where I'm going. Who would you like to be here when you die? I asked. The questions are blunt because she doesn't have time. If the meds need to be increased to alleviate her suffering, this may be the last chance to talk and record her wishes. My husband. How about your kids? Have you considered them being here? Yes, she said, but I said all I need to say. I don't want them to see this. It's done. Tears quietly flowed. Do you want to be awake or asleep when it happens? Asleep. That'll likely be the case, I said, because there's no need for you to be suffering pain like this. I'd like to check with the nurse and see what can be done. It would mean increasing your Dilaudid. You'd fall asleep here and wake up to whatever's waiting for you. Will that be all right? Yes. It was the first time she had smiled in a long time. Are you afraid to fall asleep? No, she said, it's okay. Silence. Hold the silence. Hold the space. Never speak until you can improve upon silence. And then I asked, do you remember the feeling that you spoke of when we first met, the presence of God? She smiled. Yeah, but God seems far away. I thought to myself, this would be a good time for me to take off my shoes. I'm on holy ground. It won't be long, I said. A few hours, perhaps. I think you'll see God soon, and you will dance, you will be free, and you'll watch over your daughters. Try not to interfere with them too much. We both laughed. It is a beautiful and amazing thing to hear a dying person laugh. But she also winced. Laughter exercises your insides, and hers were in no state for a workout. I'm going to go check with your nurse. Let's get you comfortable. Thank you so much, Dave. Thank you for talking about it. It really helps. Thank you, I said. Normally I would pray, but it didn't seem as important as alleviating her pain, so I simply lightly touched her hand, held that moment. God needed no request for anything. It was all in our hands. Some days it really falls together. The right people are at the right place for the right conversation. At the nursing desk, I found the pharmacist and her nurse were right there. We discussed pain control, and the doctor, who arrived within a minute, revised Brenda's care. She had a do not resuscitate order in place. Her husband was relieved with those decisions, and the medications were increased. Now, there's a strong desire to remain present at this point. A person is about to die. It's the most significant point in their life. In a few hours, she would undergo a transformation from this realm to the next. Her consciousness would shift from the containment of the body to the limitless flight of mystery. But that would be hours away. And the reality is there are other people suffering. My care was needed elsewhere. Wrestling with that desire not to miss this most significant event, I felt the weight of death move into me. And then awareness that I'd done all I needed to do. She was prepared. But we were not. The pharmacist, the doctor, the nurse, and I quietly wept as we discussed increasing her meds and saying goodbye. There is no better care than that infused with compassion and grief, the honoring of our own humanity and letting the pain flow. Grief shared is half as heavy, and we would have missed a golden opportunity if we had shrunk back from the communion before us. I sat with gratitude for our team as we drank from the cup of sorrow by being honestly and vulnerably present to each other. It was a tribute to Brenda's beautiful spirit and to our own. In that moment, we were fully broken and fully alive. Brenda died that evening, comfortable and quiet in medicated sleep, her husband and the nurse at her side. Their hearts were filled with the strange harmony of gratitude and grief. The sorrow of losing his beloved and the smile of realizing her freedom played out upon her husband's face as he watched her breathing slow, fade, and slip away. I heard that he sat for hours afterwards, taking that rare opportunity most shy away from, to contemplate life and death, the brief journey of love, and the wilderness that follows. It's all about the love. I meet so many people, walk into a patient's room, they instantly feel guilty and awkward. The chaplain shows up. Oh, I haven't been to church in a very long time, they say. They don't quite know what to do with me. They think I'm there because they're going to die. Sometimes I am. But most of the time I'm just there to help them cope. Help them connect with love during the crisis of their lives. Because your spirituality is not determined by your belief. It is determined by your love. Now the reason I say this is because all healthy spiritual traditions indicate that love is the bottom line. It's all about the love. In the Christian tradition, I think of the story of Jesus walking along a road. He's traveling and a rich man comes up to him and says, Lord, what must I do to inherit the kingdom of heaven? And Jesus says, well, what does the scriptures tell you? And the man replies, well, they say, love God with your whole heart and love your neighbor as yourself. And Jesus says, there you go. Pretty simple. He thought that there would be some obligations of the law that he needed to fulfill. He thought that there was some things he needed to check off. And Jesus says, no, just love. Again, in John 17, we have Jesus praying for his disciples and for all who would come after in the Garden of Gethsemane just before he's going to be arrested. And in his prayer, Jesus says, Father, may they be one as you and I are one. Them in us, me in you, us in them. So he's talking about a merging of consciousness. And this is the agenda of love. Love connects consciousness. as you love someone, the deeper you love them, the more your consciousness is actually entwined with theirs. What happens to them resonates in you. Which is why grief is the price you pay for love. The closer you get to someone, the more it's going to hurt when you lose them. Because you also lose part of yourself, your identity, your very nature. And that leaves a hole in your heart that will take years to grow into and will never be filled. And it's worth it. Even in the face of this kind of pain and loss, it's worth it. Because love is to resonate with God, for God is love. Period. Belief. What do we do with belief? Belief is important, but it's not what we think, which is the big problem I find in our culture. In the West, we tend to believe with our head, with our brain, an intellectual assent, an acceptance of dogmas or doctrines or ideas. But Jesus, in that prayer, was talking about belief not as something from here, but from the heart. You don't believe in Jesus. You don't believe in God. You believe into God. For love connects consciousness. All of us already are connected to God because we are conscious, loving beings. Consciousness is the only real estate we share with the divine. And as we love, we resonate in our own unique ways with that mysterious underlying consciousness from which the universe and reality arises. And we stumble with it. We do it pretty good now and then. When we do not know how to love, we often injure those that we try to love. But we are evolving. Slowly evolving into love. And I believe when we die, that process of spiritual evolution continues. I do not want to sit on a cloud playing a harp. I am not musical in any way. But the idea of evolving in consciousness, perhaps on an eternal path towards something that is completely congruent, aware, connected, that's exciting. It means more challenges, more difficult relationships. It does not mean everything's perfect. Don't know how it will be, but we're all going to find out one day, aren't we? Brenda knows it in full. Yeah. Do we come back?
No. Well, yes. It all depends on whether you believe in reincarnation or not.
Yeah. And even reincarnation, I think, is, if that's the case, it's going to be more complex than we imagine. You know, we tend to base our belief, of course, on what we know. It's our experience, and it's what we see. It's what we feel. But this is a less than 5% of reality. Cosmologists, astronomers, tell us that shocking statistic that over 95% of the universe is complete mystery. No idea what it is. And yet we get stuck in believing this is all there is, because this is all we've known. Then when we die, perhaps we are released from the limitations of the physical realm, perhaps we move to or through the quantum reality to some other levels of reality. In discussing this with a brilliant and annoyingly articulate patient. We were grappling with metaphysics as he was on the edge of immortality. And we both concluded, focus on the love and you're going to be doing the best thing you can do. I'll read you one more story. There's no greater privilege than accompanying the dying to witness a soul's transition from this world to whatever's next. There's no greater heartbreak either. The capacity to hold these two extremes in the cradle of compassion is what determines the quality of our presence. It is what determines the depth of care we embody, and ultimately it becomes our practice, our rehearsal, for the day when each of us dies, when we fall asleep to this and awake to that which is beyond the poverty of words. At 14, Josh was the youngest patient we had ever had. And he was one of our favorites, not just because of his youth. Josh's spirit was contagious, his optimism a treasure, and his graciousness humbled us all. Never did he complain. In fact, he made a point to brighten everybody's day. He'd invite me to join him in a video game called Little Big World. It's a game in which a small character made of sackcloth and yarn accomplishes grand adventures against insurmountable foes in a hand-stitched world that looks like a scrapbooker's dream. Little Big World suited him perfectly, with his diminutive stature shrunken all the more by towering IV poles laden with pumps and tubes. Because of his irrepressible kindness, Josh was the hardest to care for. Nurses, heartbroken by his grace and cheer, would quietly cry in the charting room. Doctors would pause in the hallway to collect themselves. We knew his chances were slim. Nevertheless, he was willing to face the perils of this big world and seemed inspired by the spunk of the animated character on the screen. Besides, he said nonchalantly, if I die, maybe I'll get another life. Needles, implanted access ports, weight loss, diarrhea, vomiting, chemo, more chemo, all to eradicate his immune system so we could at 3 a.m. infuse him with a new one. The procedure looks much less grand than the name. It hardly feels like a transplant. Stem cells, chilled in their preservative, then warmed in a portable sink which gently rocks them to distribute the heat. And then after administering drugs to prevent nausea, the cells are hung and infused through the IV. The room will be crowded. Two doctors, a transplant technician, a nurse, his parents, and silence as we watch for signs of reaction. Rigors, fever, redness in the skin, and there lies Josh, small in the bed, smiling as his mother rocks and prays. Don't worry, Mom, he says. I'm a fighter. And it goes smoothly. There's no reaction, there's no bumps, sighs of relief. It took barely 20 minutes. And now the magic. Stem cells course through his body, communicating with every system, seeking out the area most in need of repair. And there they set up camp, analyze, and begin to produce whatever the body requires at that moment, such as an entirely new immune system. Over the next few days, the stem cells will travel to the bone, the deepest core of the body, and within that skeletal factory, new white blood cells, which will defend Josh against the myriad microbial enemies that swarm our inner world, will be attacked and controlled. Health is a constant balancing act, and now the enemy within is most dangerous. The bacteria, which normally exist in symbiotic truce, will soon take advantage of the lack of immunity. With no system, they grow out of control, and the body will be transformed into a war zone, while microscopically, a few newborn white blood cells will take on the swarm. Little Big World, we are it. Josh is fine for a few days. But then, the flesh begins to attack the immune system. It's called graft versus host. The storm in which over 70% of unrelated donor transplants will endure. It starts with a fever, then skin irritation, then the liver, then the gut. Pneumonia, mucositis, the list goes on. Steroids are given to Josh to combat the trials. Ironically, immunosuppressants are added to tame the very stem cells we have infused to give the body time to get to know its new ally. While in this battle, there's Josh. He plays his video game, a valiant and fragile ragdoll of a character going against dragons and robots and alligator-infested pits. That was the best therapy he could have had. One day, the nurse called me. David, Josh is having a hard time. His skin is itchy and flaking off. He can't get any sleep. Can you try therapeutic touch? That might help. A therapeutic touch is something that I use regularly with patients. I work with the energy field of consciousness and help to reprogram the body from that level. It reduces side effects and helps boost immunity. The results can be wonderful. His mom was sitting by the bed, nervously rocking, while Josh was chipper as ever. "I hear you're going through one of those bumps we talked about," I said. That was an understatement. He looked like he was molting. I explained therapeutic touch and Josh agreed, and it turned out to be very effective. One of the few things that could relax him and relieve the itching. But the infections continued to overwhelm his body. The kidney failure turned his eyes the color of his sackcloth avatar. His limbs bloated with fluid. He became less animated. I treated him daily, watching him deteriorate until one day I came in. The bed was empty. The nurse, her eyes moist, said, "He's in intensive care. They want you to go down. Things don't look good." The curtain was closed. Another nurse sat pensively at the desk. We'd never had a patient so young in the intensive care. They usually go to the children's hospital next door, but his transplant required a different level of care. And that care had run out. We had no options. Josh was on life support. The new stem cells, full of promise and potential, had been rejected by his body. I pulled the curtain. There was Josh, small in the bed. Monitors, a wall around him. His family were gathered in grief. And I stood alone at the other side of the bed, looking into their eyes. "Thank you for coming, David. We were wondering if you could give him one more treatment. It's the only thing that seemed to relax him." "Of course," I said. So many times I've given therapeutic touch to those in pain, who are nauseous or in distress, but at death it is especially humbling. I am entering into a soul's essence, the vital energy of consciousness about to transition from this world. I close my eyes to center myself. There's a shift in the room. The family seems to recede. As I move my hands over his frail body, opening through the heart, I listen to find fear. So alone, so overwhelmed. "We're all here, Josh." I try to infuse my thoughts with compassion. "We are here. We are with you, your whole family. Feel our love. We're all with you." And then I pour love in. Tears well up. Don't shrink back just because it is hard. Hold the grief. Honor the humanity. Then I open my eyes and I look up. And across from the bed of me is a face I know and never would expect to see. It is my best friend, who happens to be their minister. His eyes are filled with tears as he says, "It's all right. Keep going." And with that, seems to be gone. A peace and depth fill the room, and I am able to send in the message he knew already. I said, "God will receive you, the love and the light will receive you. You will be more safe and alive than you ever were here. Your family's love is always part of you, and it's safe to go." Treatment over, I look up again. The room seems to have shifted back to normal proportions. My friend is there smiling through his tears, and the family smile as well. "I felt fear at first," I tell them, "but now I feel he knows you are here and that he is loved. There could have been no greater message for him." After embracing, Josh's parents ask if they could have a few moments alone while the machines are shut off. It didn't take long. They emerged trembling and aware and exhausted and so, so sad. We all knew he was free not only from suffering but of the limitations of life on this level, though we sensed he was so much more as well. Just as the fragile character in Josh's game overcame insurmountable odds through the guidance of the player's unseen hand, we trusted that God had guided his course and shaped his character and pulled him from oblivion. Josh would now be shining, enhanced, and embraced by nothing less than love that underpins the universe. Because Josh was, or is, an emanation of that love, he continues in the journey of evolutionary consciousness, encountering new challenges and adventures as a spiritual being with a body but so unlike ours. He is now one among the billions who travel that mystery, that little big world, becoming the hero of his journey and the hero of our hearts. We would walk with that assurance out of the valley of the shadow of death, but not out of the valley of shadow of grief. For that wisdom and pain was for us to hold, to learn, to allow it to shape us, to deepen our humanity, to help us live with renewed awareness of the gift of life. We embraced, we gathered once again at his bed, we prayed, we gave thanks for this young light. The family spent time with his body, the shell of what was, and I returned to my office to weep before moving on to the next patient. The issue is not, is there a God? The issue is, what is consciousness? What was it that animated his tiny body and then was gone? Medicine and science have no idea what consciousness is. There's no adequate explanation. It is either a quality that arises from neural activity in the brain or is mediated through. Whatever the answer to that is, once again, the most noble and beautiful response we can have is to focus on the love. Maybe not to try so much to figure out what is the soul and what is life is about, what is life about. And put more energy into loving each other, loving ourselves, and trusting that in some mysterious way that helps to heal the world and help us resonate with the mystery that underlies it all. For 15 years, I have provided spiritual care to those at the edge of life. I have more questions now than answers. But I have more love and more gratitude as well. I'm also getting worn out. So in 2017, I've taken a sabbatical for a year to recharge the batteries. I pray I haven't drained yours through some sad stories, but perhaps awakened your curiosity about how to engage your spirituality simply through love. More than emotion, let it be the highest level of consciousness that you are evolving into, and fumble along with it in your own awkward ways. It begins, as the story mentioned, with the individual, then it ripples out to our home, our family. Sometimes they are the most difficult people to love, and then into the world. Thank you so much for having me out.